This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
This week, we saw a new, unwritten chapter in India's history being created.
Earlier this month, in the world's largest democracy, a dark and ominous turn. In the disputed state of Kashmir, half administered by Hindu-majority India and half by its Muslim-majority rival Pakistan, India has revoked autonomy for the Jammu and Kashmir region in its control, despite the 67% Muslim majority there. With the stroke of a pen, that majority's political power and constitutionally guaranteed rights have been obliterated.
Article 370, the section of the Constitution that gives significant autonomy to Kashmir, is at the heart of why the region joined India in 1947. It allows the regional government to make its own laws, except in finance, defense, foreign affairs, and communications.
Kashmiri Muslims complain bitterly about their rights and identity being stolen from them.
It's moved at lightning speed without any consultation.
The de facto annexation of the autonomous region into the whole of India is the formalization of long-standing claims on the Himalayan territory. Claims that have been prosecuted with wars, political rhetoric, and widespread human rights abuses against Muslim citizens. And thus, the legislative fiat of the ruling Hindu nationalist BJP was more shock than surprise.
It's been a part of their platform for decades, so it's not a surprise that they were interested in trying to remove this Article 370 and make Jammu and Kashmir a formal part of India without special autonomy.
What has changed over those decades has been the consolidation of political power into the hands of Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his BJP and the popular acceptance of the action in the name of both national destiny and national security. Modi claimed that absorbing Jammu Kashmir will create greater regional stability.
The reason that he gave for removing Article 370, which had given Kashmir its special status and greater autonomy, was simple. He said it hadn't worked at all. He said all it had brought was nepotism, separatism, and terrorism.
Thus, under the pretext of hampering terrorist reprisals, the assault on Kashmiri democracy was carried out in an information vacuum. The government cut communications in Kashmir and prevented the vast majority of regional newspapers from publishing. The info blockade reportedly included even human quarantine.
They're not being allowed to come out of their houses, and they don't have any access to any sort of news or information. The phone lines are down, the internet has been blocked, and cable TV is also blocked in parts of Kashmir.
Where protests took place, the government denied their existence. Even when the BBC showed video of the police opening fire and using tear gas to disperse a crowd, Modi's administration claimed no such demonstration or police action ever took place. Not that, outside of Kashmir, there was much evidence of anger.
Celebrations breaking out in different parts of the country. This is a historic moment. This is the day when Kashmir stands finally integrated with India.
There symbolizes the whole debate and the whole problem that exists. On the one hand, the public here in India strongly behind their prime minister. On the other hand, the Muslims who live in the valley at the moment feeling disconnected, both physically because they have no way to communicate with the rest of India and also with their government in Delhi.
How in a democracy can undemocracy be so popular? It's a question Americans lately are asking ourselves, but if we're seeking lessons from the subcontinent, in India the answer is clear. To engineer a quiet nationalist revolution, to employ the levers of democracy to subvert democracy, requires most of all control of the narrative, and not just by news blackout or legislative shenanigans or even hateful propaganda. As tyrants of the past well understood, to hold power, it is necessary to own history itself. As Indian historian Romila Thapur recently wrote in the New York Times, quote, extreme nationalists require their own particular version of the past to legitimize their actions in the present. This week, on the anniversary of India's independence, producer Asa Chaturvedi examines the ways in which India's far-right political movement, now with a grip on power, is redefining national identity by rewriting the past.
One place to find the identity of a nation is its founding documents and the ideals of those who fought for independence. In India, it was the people on the forefront of the movement to fight against 200 years of British rule.
To the people of India, whose representatives we are, we make appeal to join us with faith and confidence in this great adventure.
That's India's first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, speaking in 1947 to the Constituent Assembly of India in the country's parliament on the eve of independence. He outlined an egalitarian vision for the country.
This is no time for petty and destructive criticism, no time for ill will or blaming others. We have to build the noble mansion of free India where all her children may dwell.
The Indians' founding principle was a unity in diversity where no matter who you were, you spoke your language, you practiced your faith.
Shoaib Daniyal is a writer for Scroll, an independent English language news site based in India. He covers politics and culture.
Wherever in India you form, no matter the way you looked, you could still buy into the civic nationalism of India, and you could still be Indian in that way.
Today, India is the world's largest democracy, with 1.3 billion people. In 1947, it was the job of Nehru and the Assembly to bring together the diverse interests of the world's youngest democracy. For example, the Constitution itself recognizes 22 languages.
These values are enshrined in India's Constitution, which is drawn up by a Constituent Assembly consisting mainly of people who had fought for freedom against the British. This is happening against incredible bloodshed between Hindus and Muslims when partition happens.
As India celebrated independence, the country was divided into two nation-states. An estimated 15 million people were uprooted as Hindus and Sikhs moved to India and Muslims moved to Pakistan. Despite sectarian violence that has continued over many decades, the ideals of a multicultural, diverse India were still the country's North Star.
And unity and diversity was really pushed out. You know, I remember this right till the 90s when I was a kid, where, you know, you would have these government ads. Basically showed a Muslim and a Hindu and a Sikh and a Christian sort of hanging out and you're doing their thing. There was this message sent out that India sort of belonged to everyone who lived in India.
How is the story of India changing now and who's behind it?
The main actor, I think, behind it is the Bharatiya Janata Party, which just translates to Indian People's Party.
Shortened to the BJP, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's party.
They have a very specific and very distinct idea of India from what India was founded on. They believe India is a Hindu nation. In this scenario, if you're a Muslim, if you're a Christian, you sort of get excluded. So this was a doctrine championed by a person who lived in colonial India called Vinayak Savarkar.
Savarkar, a far-right independence activist and writer, popularized the ideology of Hindu nationalism called Hindutva. In 1923, in an influential text, he wrote that Hindutva is, quote, not a word, but a history.
He basically says that anyone who considers India his holy land is a true Indian. Anyone who has holy places outside of India, for example, Catholics have the Vatican in Europe and Muslims have Mecca in Saudi Arabia, they are not really truly Indian.
The BJP draws inspiration from Savarkar's work and traces its roots back to a pro-Hindu group founded in 1925, the most influential of which is
the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, which translates to the National Volunteers Organization.
The RSS. They aren't a political party. They don't stand in elections.
Almost every important person in the BJP was once a member.
This includes Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The tentacles of the RSS spread far and wide.
The RSS has worked at the grassroots for decades. Nobody knew in the 1960 that the BJP would one day come to power.
The rise of the BJP can be traced back to the 1980s, when Hindu nationalists led a violent movement to demolish a mosque in North India and build a Hindu temple in its place.
India is in political turmoil. At least 100 people have died in religious violence, which has erupted across the country since militant Hindus tore down a mosque in the northern town of Ayodhya yesterday.
There were riots all throughout the country, you know, for almost a year. Tens of thousands of people were killed.
One government minister said it was the worst crisis for secular India since Mahatma Gandhi's assassination in 1948.
Hindutva goes from being this fringe ideology and sort of comes to occupy center stage. That's when the BJP becomes the largest party in India's parliament.
Fundamental to the Hindu nationalist message is that Hindus are native to India. Historians have found that actually the origins of Hinduism came from the mixing of a thriving civilization in northwest India and the Aryans who came from outside India, something the Hindu nationalists deny.
Because they want the Hindus to be the sons of the soil, and therefore they are rewriting the Indian history in that light.
Christophe Jaffrelot is a senior research fellow at the French National Center for Scientific Research and visiting professor at the King's College India Institute.
The second thing that they are very much keen on is to depict the Islamization of India, the way Islam became one of the important religions of India, as a violent process.
Historians have pointed to the fact that Hindu rulers could be just as violent and that the RSS interpretations disregard important alliances between Hindus and Muslims.
And the last and probably most important thing that they want to change is related to the freedom movement.
An Indian newspaper recently reported that certain textbooks had erased all mention of India's first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru. Nehru was a member of the Congress Party, a major rival of the ruling BJP.
They replace these heroes by their own personalities at the expense of the previous figures.
And obviously one of the best ways to do that is through education, is through changing textbooks.
Shoaib Daniyal.
The RSS has a veto power on who's the education minister in India. That is something that the RSS considers key to its job, reaching kids when they're like 5 or 8 or 15. That's the best way to do it.
Most of the process of rewriting textbooks to suit the so-called saffron agenda, named for the color Hindus regard as sacred, comes at the state level, states where the BJP has won.
Critics of the Bhairav Singh Shekhawat government in Rajasthan say that the BJP is changing the very face of the curriculum by slipping in their saffron agenda.
First, Rajasthan and Uttar Pradesh, and now Mughal history has disappeared from Maharashtra state board textbooks.
Whatever we have learnt from British and Muslim emperors should be removed. It is time for our government to put the right heroes in the syllabus.
And the saffronization is not limited to grade schools. At the University of Delhi, the history, political science, sociology, and English department syllabi were revised last month.
So it goes through a four-step process.
Nandini Sundar is a professor at the Department of Sociology. This year, the syllabus creation and approval process was following the usual steps.
The teachers themselves who are involved in teaching the courses, the department committee of courses, the faculty level, and then the academic council.
Until the National Democratic Teachers Front, a right-wing teachers union backed by the RSS, and a student group within the RSS family protested for changes.
English syllabus, they objected to a short story which showed the militant wing of the RSS in a bad light for their role in the 2002 Gujarat massacres in which large numbers of Muslims were killed. In the sociology syllabus, they wanted material on the joint family and ancient India to be included. In the history syllabus, they objected to various modules, including some things which were actually in a different period. It's really shutting down this university as a space for students, telling them that they cannot really exercise their critical faculties, that they must know only one side of a story, that anything that is open to debate or different interpretation is somehow taboo.
step outside the classroom, and the rewriting of history is being enacted on brick and mortar.
All right, today we're asking, what's in a name? Well, a lot of political...
In India, you have this campaign of renaming anything that has been named after a Muslim king.
Remember the century-old Mughal Sarai station on the busy Delhi-Howrah route? Well, it is getting a quick saffron makeover now. It will formally be renamed after RSS...
Even language in India, a country with more than 19,500 languages and dialects, is a contested ground.
A massive controversy erupted today over a proposal to possibly impose Hindi as a language in all schools.
They released the new education policy, which said that no matter your actual native language, you might be a Tamil speaker, you might be a Gujarati speaker, you might be a Bengali speaker, but you must learn Hindi.
The proposal didn't go through this time. Daniel, the reporter, says that in his speeches, even the Prime Minister himself has changed the narrative of Indian history.
When Mr. Modi made his first speech in Parliament 5 years back in 2014, it was almost a throwaway comment, you know, and you would have missed it if you sort of weren't cued in. He basically said India is now just getting over 1,200 years of slavery. Just this figure exemplifies a drastic shift in how India sees its own history. The standard narrative of Indian history is that India was under colonial rule for 200 years, which is under the British, right? The British basically first capture power in India in 1757, and then they leave in 1947, so that's 190 years, so 2 centuries of British colonialism. Usually, the kingdoms before that are not seen as colonial entities. But Modi wants us to see them as colonial entities. That's because a large number of medieval kingdoms in India were basically kingdoms ruled by Muslims. So in the Hindutva view of India, that is also colonial rule, much in the sense of how British rule is colonial rule. You know, this is a very fringe view of history, which sort of pushes that India has been a colonial power for 1,000 years.
I asked political scientist Christoph Jafferlow what he would say to those who claim that India's history for the last 70 years was rewritten by the people who want to cover up a true Hindu history.
It's a science history. It's a social science, but it's a science. So you have to get archives. You need to have evidence when you make some claim. We have archaeologists, historians, linguists who have been in a position to show for decades, here is the history that we can substantiate, for which there is evidence. They would respond to that by invoking not history, but legends.
Now there's yet another science and tech shocker from a BJP chief minister said that technology existed in this country during the Mahabharat time. That is, satellite communication existed during the Mahabharat time. If you don't believe me, listen for yourself.
Some of the impacts of the Hindu nationalists' efforts to rewrite the story of India are obvious and direct.
The Indian youth will probably not know the history of India it should if things continue at the same pace. You see young Indians ignorant of basic realities of India's history and living in fantasy to a large extent.
He points out that we've seen this story before in India's neighbor, Pakistan.
Pakistan has started the process of rewriting of history, of Islamization of the history of Pakistan long time ago. And the young Pakistanis don't know what their history is about.
In other ways, the movement, combined with the effects of policies like the revocation of Article 370 in Kashmir, mean that the nature of Indian democracy is changing and that minorities are marginalized.
At the end of the day, the minorities cannot be recognized as full-fledged citizens because they don't have the same rights. They don't have the same access to jobs, to land, to their rights. So it's not only because of the writing of history, for sure, but it's a trend that is taking India on the ethnic democracy way.
All of this, of course, is happening against the backdrop of a marked rise in right-wing populism around the world. In Poland, a law was passed that makes it a civil offense to hold Poland responsible for the Holocaust. In Brazil, President Jair Bolsonaro denies that the Portuguese were responsible for the country's slave industry, saying that Brazil, quote, owes no debt to its black citizens. And in Turkey, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's party has taken steps to remove the study of evolution from schools and has purged academics who favored democratic governance. And if some of this sounds at all familiar, it's because it is.
History may be getting an overhaul in Texas as the State Board of Education is set to vote on a new social studies curriculum that could affect classrooms across the country.
Out! Too much talk about Thomas Jefferson and the Enlightenment, which stressed reasoning and science over faith. In! More recognition of the contributions of religious leaders like Moses to American ideals.
This summer, Tejasvi Surya, a young, newly elected member of India's lower house of parliament and a strong supporter of Hindutva, spoke for the first time in front of the assembly of his colleagues. He was emotional as he described his personal journey.
The other most important thing that we witnessed in the last 5 years was that a culturally repressed country who could not wear its identity up its sleeve and proudly say that we belong to a civilization as great as ours, who, when a young Indian in school was made to cringe and feel apologetic that he belonged to a great Hindu faith, that has changed in the last 5 years, sir. And that, I think, is one of the irreversible changes which is beyond the confines of Indian politics.
It's hard not to hear echoes of Make India Great Again, a comeback from a conjured period of repression. This reimagining of India's story rejects the boisterous, multi-faith democracy that Nehru envisioned. Hindu, yes, but also Muslim, Christian, Buddhist, Jain, atheist, Sikh, Jewish. The list is long. And as minority voices are squeezed out of the discussion, the fear is that this rewriting could be irreversible. For On the Media, this is Asta Chaturvedi.
This is On the Media.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.